Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and from the law firm of Primer, Piper, Eggleston, and Kramer, providing comprehensive legal counsel to New Hampshire businesses and their owners for more than 30 years. For more information or to speak to an attorney, visit primer.com. And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Many parents have a long litany of concerns about the impact of video games on their kids, fears that gaming might be linked to violence, depression, anxiety, obesity, poor grades, and so on. But while sitting on a couch for 7 hours a day can't be good for anyone, emerging research does indicate that some popular games have some benefits. For example, they're way more interactive and social than that stereotypical image of the lone gamer sitting by themselves. And many allow players to explore different identities and interact with people from different backgrounds and cultures from their own. Today in The Exchange, a fresh look at video game research. Given the evolving nature of the games themselves, let's hear from you. Your questions and comments are welcome. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Dr. Paul Weigel. He's a child and adolescent psychiatrist and associate medical director at Natchog Hospital in Connecticut. He's also chair of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry's Media Committee. And Dr. Weigel, it's a real pleasure having you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us in studio, Professor Mary Flanagan. She's a professor of film and media studies at Dartmouth College and founder of Tilt Factor, Game Design for Social Change. And Professor Flanagan, nice to see you. Welcome back.
Good to be here, Laura. Thank you.
And Professor Flanagan, I want to start with you. What type of games do you study, and what type of games do you think are most important to look at right now? Because things are changing.
Things are changing. In fact, we use games as part of a larger research trajectory, so we're often inventing new kinds of games for social causes, for social change. So, for example, we might be trying to combat implicit biases that we all harbor in our minds and see if we can actually invent a new way of addressing them. Things like sexual assault prevention, things like stereotypes about women in science. These are the kinds of topics we invent new games to address. So we're really looking at the ways in which we can use play in a positive effect.
Well, would kids, sorry to be so cynical right off the top, but would kids play a game that's sort of teaching them to be better human beings? I mean, it feels sort of preachy.
Oh, it certainly would be if we followed a stereotypical path along that way, yes. Our games actually rarely appear to be what they are.
Okay.
We really embed messages with a particular methodology that we call embedded design. So it's important that the game actually be fun first. But all games have messages, all media have messages. So we are just very intentional about how they come across.
So we'll definitely talk a little bit later about the types of games that you're creating, Professor Flanagan. But what types of games do you think, as a researcher, are important to be looking at right now?
Well, I think any popular game is worthy of study. It's unfortunate that we don't have a vast majority of researchers looking at games, given their popularity and their cultural importance. I think that what's interesting to me is, in fact, the social aspects of games, but also the ways in which we have emotional responses to games. Things like empathy comes up, the fascination with empathy comes up a lot, especially as we move to virtual reality and immersive environments. And also the ways in which games can facilitate different kinds of conversations. I'm also very interested in the way in which we problem solve in games and how that can really benefit us later in life if the problems have interesting solutions.
Very interesting. How about you, Dr. Weigel? What sort of games do you think are really important for researchers like you and Professor Flanagan to be looking at?
Well, I agree with Professor Flanagan that the games the kids are playing are really the most important. And as a clinician who treats mental illness in children and adolescents, I'm most concerned with encouraging and helping parents to encourage a healthy balance in the lives of young people, and how video game habits in particular can affect mental illness, both for better and for worse.
That's interesting. So I have not often heard researchers, Dr. Weigel, say video games can impact mental health for better or for worse. I haven't heard for better. So tell me a little bit about that.
Well, you know, with the rise of screen media in general and video games in particular in the lives of young people, there have been some really positive changes that perhaps we wouldn't have dreamt of around the turn of the millennia. So since the year 2000, kids are spending about three times as much time playing video games as they were then. And along with that, there's been some wonderful changes. Some of the things that parents worry about the most with young people, in particular teenagers, for example, there's concern, and rightly so, that violent video games might make kids more aggressive, and yet the violent crime rate among young people has plummeted. It's half of what it was in the 90s. In addition, so they may be shooting each other online, but not on the streets, and which is a really wonderful change. In addition, teen pregnancy rates have plummeted. So kids may not be dating as much, but teen pregnancy rates are half of what they were across, you know, different ethnicities compared to the year 2000. Drug, alcohol, cigarette use among teenagers has declined significantly, particularly cigarette and alcohol use, which is past month use is been found to be half of what it was, again, around the year 2000. And with less young people driving, the number of young people who are killed, teens who are killed in traffic accidents, has plummeted as well and is half of what it was. So there's some really important and good things to have, important effects that have happened with this huge generational change with young people spending more time on screens. And one of them is that they're physically safer.
Wow, that is amazing. I'd love what you think, Professor Flanagan, too. Those markers that parents often worry about, substance abuse, crime, teen pregnancy, car crashes, all the stuff that keeps parents of teenagers like myself up at night.
Right.
Dr. Weigel's telling us that these are down and screen use is way, way up.
Yes, it is. It is an interesting phenomenon. I mean, the research has really been divided for years and years about the positive and negative effects, and unfortunately, negative effects have gotten a lot of press. But I do think that in some ways, people looking for problems often find correlations. We can also find, as Dr. Weigel suggests, correlations for good, and some very interesting studies on that, as well as the differences internationally in the research. Some American researchers have found the link between video games and violence in some larger meta studies. But also, video games researchers in Europe have actually found no link between any kind of aggressive behavior and video games, and in fact look to television as a main culprit. So we have some pretty divided literature. It's very difficult to study video games out of context. We're in a media saturated environment. There are screens around us in airports and waiting rooms and everything. So we really have to look at, perhaps if we're thinking about violence in particular, we have to look at all the cultural messages that we send out.
I want to remind our listeners that we would love to hear from you. The number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Today in the exchange, a look at emerging video game research. We'd love to get your questions or comments in on this topic. You can give us a call at 1-800-892-6477 or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. What do you want to know about the impact of video games, especially on young people? One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. So, Professor Flanagan, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, the conversation over video games seemed to be, are they good or bad for kids, for the young developing body and brain? It sounds like from listening to you and Dr. Weigel, that conversation is changing.
The conversation is changing to consider, for example, the idea of inclusion, that video games might actually be appealing to a wider population. They're being made slowly but surely by a wider and diverse creative base. And we're seeing a lot of new kinds of players, women over 50, for example. and the number one growing video game audience are women over 50. So it's not only for young people. The little bit of the average gamer in the United States is about 35 years old.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So we don't necessarily always have this link between young people and video games. But the fascination is that spending all the screen time in an immersive world somehow takes people away from the real world. And I think if we just look back to our own childhoods, perhaps, before the influx of video games, and we see, I spent a lot of time reading novels, or I spent, kids spend a lot of time doing the things they love. and I don't think most of us are worse for wear for reading too many novels. So I also like to just de-escalate the conversation, the suspicion of the secret technology or something like that. It's not necessarily a bad thing.
Well, and I'm so glad you raised that, and I'd love to get your thoughts too, Dr. Weigel. How much of the concern that we hear about video games, you know, is for real, concerns about mental health and so forth, and we'll talk about physical health in a moment as well. And how much is it due to just what Professor Flanagan is hinting at, adults inherently suspicious of anything new that they didn't do when they were kids? What do you think, Dr.
Sure.
Michael?
Yeah, so that there is an element of, concern about, are adults always sort of worried about what kids are doing? And it reminds me of when I was young and there was a great deal of concern about kids playing Dungeons and Dragons and that having an awful effect. And, of course, that's just another version of a story that's been going on for a long time, every generation, it seems. However, I do think that it's important to phrase the idea in not just are video games bad or good, because inherently they really are neither. It's what type of game, how they're played, what type of habits young people get into that's the most important. Professor Flanagan had indicated that young people spend a lot of times indulging their interests, and that can be both positive and negative. I do think that my take on the literature and studies indicate that entertainment media have changed the nature of childhood and adolescence, and that young people are spending so much time, an average of 7 hours a day for screen entertainment, according to recent studies for teenagers, that it has begun to displace other healthy habits that young people really need to engage in order to lead happy and healthy lives. And what I'm talking about is activities with academic value, like reading for fun. I'm talking about in-person socializing. Although it's very true that playing Fortnite, introduces you to other people and you do have a real connection with them, it is a very limited one, and it really does not serve the same, function for mental health and growth that in-person socialization does. Another thing is, of course, adequate exercise and physical movement, and finally, adequate sleep, which is so important for mental health in a number of different ways. Studies show that young people are sleeping less than before, and a lot of it has to do with their technology habits.
Yeah, and that is definitely not good for your mental and physical health, as we know. So it seems like you're saying, Dr. Weigel, it's not so much playing video games. As Professor Flanagan said, kids spend a lot of time doing things they love, whether it's Dungeons and Dragons or reading novels or whatever. You seem to be more quibbling with it's just too much time doing one thing.
For most, it is. And of course, there's a lot of variation, right? Some young people really don't spend too much time playing games or engaging in other technology at all. And then there's 25% of teens, according to research, that are classified as heavy users that spend about 13 hours a day, which over the course of a year is about four times the amount of time they spend in school. And this is a quarter of American teens, according to the Common Sense Media Survey. So it certainly varies by individual, but for some, it can become a really, really unhealthy habit that just crowds out, you know, other parts of their life that support growth and health.
Professor Flanagan, what do you think?
Well, I'm definitely in agreement about there is a level of what is too much, but I'm also really concerned about the ways in which video games reveal. There are answers in video games. You know, you get feedback. You have points. You know when you're winning. It feels good. There are problems to solve. The setup is understandable. That's not like the real world. The real world's a little bit more fuzzy. And I do wonder sometimes if we're kind of creating games that teach a little bit too much of a clarity or a lack of ambiguity. Missions in life are very different. Challenges in life are very different. So the kinds of problem solving we get packaged in a game are really interesting and good, but too much may, again, limit us as far as being flexible thinkers.
That's super interesting. I'd love to hear a little bit more from you on that. Again, especially for people who maybe don't have a familiarity with video games, it seems like you're saying that success in a video game is treasures won, enemies knocked out, territories conquered. Success in real life isn't as data-driven or as measurable.
That's right. And we still need to find an intrinsic reward instead of an extrinsic reward in the way we conduct ourselves, right? The way we find meaning in life.
Dr. Weigel, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Video games are very good at meeting us at just the right challenge level. So if you're playing a game, you have to fully engage in order to be successful. But if you do give your full attention, you are likely to be successful. And as you get better at the game is very good at increasing the complexity and challenge so that you are always in that sweet spot of, you know, of this zone of flow where you're engaged completely. And unlike the real, this is different than a real world task, in that real world tasks sometimes, you know, involve frustrations, you know, that are much higher and areas which are sort of boring or times that you really have to practice patience. And so real world tasks, you know, are much more frustrating and require really a lot more patience in order to learn real world skills when compared to games, which really are good at just challenging players in just the right way, but they don't necessarily, you know, encourage the development of sort of grit.
Oh, it's really interesting. And coming up in just a moment, I want to ask both of you about that, the idea that real life can be boring and a little more ambiguous and how that translates for young people across from their video game play to their academic work. We'll talk about that after a very short break.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest and You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, a fresh look at video game research and the evolving nature of the games themselves. Let's hear from you. Call in 1-800-892-6477. Send email to exchange at nhpr.org. Use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, that email, exchange at nhpr.org. And the phone number is 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, Professor Mary Flanagan. She's a professor of film and media studies at Dartmouth College and founder of Tilt Factor, Game Design for Social Change. Joining us by phone, Dr. Paul Weigel, child and adolescent psychiatrist and associate medical director at Natchog Hospital in Connecticut. And Dr. Weigel, to you first, so at this point, lots of research, as you and Professor Flanagan said in the first part of the show, different conclusions sometimes from America versus Europe. Is there anything that we definitively know, Dr. Weigel, about the impact of video games on young people and what we don't know? Can we really measure anything at this point? Or is it all still sort of a matter of research and opinion?
Yeah, I think it depends on how much, it really depends on how much research someone, you know, that needs to be published, or how much evidence is enough to say we really know something. I mean, in order to do the kind of experiments that would really tell us what we want to know, we would have to do experiments where we assign young people to play certain video games for a certain amount of time for years, and these are experiments that are just impossible to do. However, we do have a wealth of information. We're talking hundreds of scientific studies looking at correlations and sometimes looking at effects over time of changes with gaming habits, so that there is a lot that we do know. And speaking in broad terms, you know, Dr. Flanagan mentioned, Professor Flanagan mentioned that there is different research about the effects of video games on violent behavior. But to my knowledge, or as far as I can tell from the literature, there hundreds of studies do show this sort of persistent effect of video game play, violent video game play, and aggressive thoughts and behaviors. Now, this isn't necessarily violence, right? And as I mentioned before, playing violent video games, which most kids do, has not made a nation of violent kids. It hasn't done that. But there is a significant persistent effect found in the significant majority of studies linking violent video game play to aggressive thoughts and behaviors. So, but the effect size is small. So what I'm saying here is that it seems to me that that playing violent video games for an extended period of time will not make a mild-mannered kid into a physically aggressive kid necessarily, but it does sort of inch them along that line towards aggressive, towards aggression, or spending time in this sort of hostile world of kill or be killed. It does seem to have an effect on making a child sort of a little bit more aggressive, a little bit less likely to engage in kind behavior, that kind of thing. So my take on the literature is there is a small but persistent effect of violent video games.
What do you think, Professor Flanagan? That's, I think, the number one concern of most parents and adults in general, that violent video games might contribute in some way to violent behavior or aggressive behavior, as the doctor says.
Well, you know, there have been large meta-analyses of existing studies throughout the last, let's just say, 10 years. And those results, as Dr. Weigel suggests, do suggest that there is, for a particular population, a slightly increased aggressive strand, if you will. So kids that might also be already prone to being aggressive might, this population is the most vulnerable to impact, like practicing violence. On the other hand, again, this could be an American problem, because when we go over to the UK, the UK Millennium Cohort Study that was just conducted in the last 2 years, they looked at 11,000 children in the UK.
That's a lot of kids.
That's a lot of kids. And they really found no link between playing electronic games with any kind of conduct problems, right? So this it could be culturally specific. It could also, again, since these studies are correlative, meaning that there's a kind of a similarity between data sets, but we don't always know exactly the cause and effect. Or it could be that the studies, you know, there are constant contradictions about violent video game studies. I will say also that a few of the early studies, academic studies on violent video games, were redacted, were removed from the research community because they were, for a variety of reasons, found insufficient. So some of the early hysteria in the academic, from the academic studies on violent video games, actually, some of those studies were removed from academic life. So, and found to be not valid studies. So we're working with an origin. It's a little bit like the vaccine crisis. You know, we have one study or one rumor or something, and everyone kind of jumps on that bandwagon, cites that paper, and suddenly we have a scientific movement. What happens when some of that initial research isn't so valid after all?
All right, let's go to our listeners. Lots more to talk about. Our number here on The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Today in The Exchange, we're taking a fresh look at video game research. Given the changing nature of some of the games themselves, a lot of interaction, a lot of problem solving, the games are not what they were 20 years ago or even 10 years ago. So we're taking a look at how the games have changed and how some of the research around gaming is changing. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. And first up is James in Nashua. Hi, James. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to share, I worked with drones in the Air Force, and specifically I worked with sensor operators and drone pilots, and conversations with sensor operators, and those are the guys that fire the missile and help guide the bombs onto the target. Firsthand, they said that they dealt with, killing and eliminating targets by, playing video games. They said it helped desensitize them from, completing their job. So I thought that was an interesting data point.
Desensitize them. So give us a little more there, James. How do you feel about that? What does that mean to you?
I basically say that I think video games, playing killing someone and then looking at a video screen at a real job, it helps them eliminate the human factor from it and makes it easier for someone to kill somebody else.
Thank you very much for calling in, James, especially given your experience. Dr. Weigel, what do you think about this?
Sure. So a number of studies have found what James is saying, that playing violent video games does have an effect of desensitizing towards violence to some degree. And certainly as an anecdotal, my brother was in the military, and when his squad wasn't knocking down doors in Iraq, they were playing Call of Duty and video games, sort of simulating, modern warfare. And there's a reason they did that. The games are very sophisticated in their ability to simulate real world violence. Anecdotally, Anders Breivik, who was a mass murderer from Norway who killed 77 people, said he trained for his killing by playing Call of Duty, as well as time at the range. So I do think that the games are so realistic that they certainly can simulate violence in a way that can translate to real world behavior.
What do you think, Professor Flanagan? I know these aren't the type of games that you are designing in your lab, Tilt Factor, but I just wonder what you think about this desensitization, lack of empathy concern with some of these games.
Well, I would say for everyone training to kill others in an online game, you have people training to cook meals and, cooking mama or like old,
many games
out
there.
We have a lot of games, right? Of course, everyone's most concerned with the most violent, but we do, if we go back to anthropologists looking at the history of play, we actually see that play can meet a variety of needs, a need for power, a need for understanding the adult world, a need for... So there are many lenses upon which we can place our understanding of video games from an anthropological standpoint. Maybe we need all of these kinds of things in some kind of measure, and perhaps for some that can be abused. I think the idea of linking games to the military is particularly interesting because, first of all, we have a history of the military using games for a recruitment tool. America's Army 15 years ago was developed by the military to get kids to join the Army. It was an online multiplayer game where it was free to download, and I played it. I've done lots of work in that environment, and it was a recruitment tool to get people excited about joining the military. So that link has been very clear. Training simulations, flight simulators. We have a lot of games used in military context. We also, interesting, however, we also use games for PTSD to overcome some of the problems people in the military have encountered in their combat, for example.
That's super interesting. Do you have a story or an example about that?
Well, several artists, in fact, have acquired video footage of people kind of healing from some PTSD experiences in Iraq with using video games as part of the healing process. We see this with phobias as well. People can use video games and immersive digital environments to kind of autocorrect or kind of work through some PTSD challenges with medical supervision. So it's very interesting to use the same kind of tool. And what that just shows me is that it's not the same kind of tool, that we're lumping together a lot of different things when we talk about video games. And one, we have video games for healing. Another, we have video games for kind of propaganda in a way. And then we have also video games for training. All of that in an entertainment context, because, of course, video games are part of a very large media and entertainment complex.
I would love to talk to both of you more about the commercial interests involved in these. As you said, the military uses some of these games as a recruiting tool. Both my boys love to play Madden, which is a football playing game, so that's fine, but it allows them to have the NFL, which is a large commercial enterprise, in front of their eyeballs, you know, all year long, not just during football season, which is pretty long already. But so it's interesting. And Mary, I know you've talked about there's some casino elements in some of these games. And,
yes.
And, you know, sort of teaching people that gambling is fun and
yes,
and
in fact,
worthwhile.
If you go to the App Store and you look at the number one selling apps and you look through history, you'll find gambling games as a very large component of what is actually popular out there. And it is a little disturbing when one is working with a bunch of professional game designers. Often professional game designers want to make good games. They want to invent new mechanics. But there are consultants from casinos, consultants from gambling institutions, who also are brought in to help video games be more addictive. Case in point, Candy Crush. You can see why Candy Crush feels like a slot machine. It's not an accident.
We will talk a lot more after a short break. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, the latest research on video games and especially their impact on young people. Let's hear from you. Call in 1-800-892-6477. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, that number, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Dr. Paul Weigel, child and adolescent psychiatrist and associate medical director at Natchog Hospital in Connecticut. With me in studio, Professor Mary Flanagan, professor of film and media studies at Dartmouth College and founder of Tilt Factor, game design for social change. And both of you, let's go right back to our listeners. Gavin's calling in from Barrington. Hi, Gavin. You're on the line. Go ahead.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call. I am a psychotherapist out of NEPI in Salem, New Hampshire, and I work primarily with young adults and adolescents, and I deal with gaming on a daily basis. And I agree with Dr. Weigel that balance is so key when understanding how to make gaming appropriate. There's obviously a lot of concerns if it gets sort of out of balance. And my brother working in the gaming industry, I can tell you that what we're seeing now is just the tip of the iceberg. What's coming in the next 5 to 10 years is going to be amazing. So that balance is really important. On the flip side, though, I can tell you in working with gaming, I've helped clients. One, for example, had very high social anxiety, and the transition from high school to college was extremely challenging. And so what I did is looked at how in learning with the games he played, how important learning maps were, the map knowledge, and we applied it to his college. And we started looking at the map, we started learning where he needed to go, and we even took a test run where he then walked the map. And in doing that, it helped reduce that anxiety and ultimately really helped him be successful in that challenge. So there's a lot of skills people and gamers are learning that can be translated to life very effectively. And I think that's an important piece to keep in mind, especially when we're looking at gaming and what it means to adolescents and young adults.
Really interesting, Gavin. Thank you so much for the call. Love to hear from both of you on this. Dr. Weigel, you first, the benefits of games, and he's, you know, Gavin's got a full picture. He doesn't say it's all good, but the benefits of games for young people who may have anxieties, who may be what's sometimes called neurodiverse. They don't learn the same way. They don't look at the world in the same way. I wonder what your thoughts are, Dr. Weigel.
Sure. So video games absolutely can be a fantastic teacher, as Professor Flanagan has reported, and they can teach us both, you know, positive or negative things. You know, we know that video games teach, of course, they train skills for eye-hand coordination, they train skills for visual tracking, the ability to mentally rotate objects, multitasking, and other cognitive abilities, even vision. The gamers have better vision, and non-gamers can improve with practice. The actual real-world application of that is a little bit less clear in the literature. Like, you might imagine that, you know, with all these, with better visual attention and better multitasking and eye-hand coordination, that gamers would be better drivers. However, the literature seems to show that although they might be more skilled drivers, gamers tend to make take higher risks while they're driving, and so maybe are actually less safe drivers. One study did show that that surgeons who play video games perform much better on surgery simulators than surgeons with similar experience who don't play games. So certainly there absolutely can be real world applicability. But speaking to Gavin's point, I do see gaming for young men as a major impediment for many young men as far as leaving the home and transitioning successfully to college, and a lot of times it's very important to consider sort of leaving the gaming console at home, because for the first time, you know, young men really don't have any parental limits on how much they're allowed to play, and it can really suck in some young people to the point where they drop out of school.
I have heard some of those legends, or I shouldn't say legends, stories, Dr. Weigel, about young men who go to college and mom isn't saying, get off, get off, get off, and so they never get off, and it turns out not well for them, which raises a question I'd like to ask you, Professor Flanagan. How do men and women interact with games differently? I have read that the male brain is more predisposed to become addicted to games than the female brain. I don't know if that's true. I'd love your thoughts.
I would say that that's probably not a definitive finding in the research. We do know that.
It's more just anecdotal.
Yeah, I think that's
it's anecdotal. A feeling.
Yeah, that's a suspicion, perhaps, or a guess. But there are a few interesting studies that suggest. So, for example, a team of researchers in Canada did a study because they're very interested in the kind of performance in games, women versus men. Is there something innate in video games that men are better at hand-eye coordination or all of these kinds of things? And when they found that everyone had the same level of hours put in, the same level of experience, the same level of practice, that there was no difference in any kind of in-game performance. And it is interesting. The only difference that has been consistent through the years is that women tend to have lower spatial reasoning scores in general, but that is often attributed to the number of hours playing three-dimensional games and, of course, objects, childhood play. So when everyone's playing with the same tools and the same toys, those differences diminish. So I don't give much credence to that. I do think there, we have social stereotypes that games are for men, that games are it's a masculine culture. But I think over time we see that actually, when we actually collect the data, it's nearing 50-50 on most game platforms, except for some of the war simulations. But for example, World of Warcraft had half women players, and I would suspect the same for Overwatch and probably Fortnite as well.
That's interesting, and that does push back at the stereotypes. So I'm glad you mentioned that. There was a rash of media articles a couple months ago, Professor Flanagan, about Fortnite addiction. And this was, you know, the Boston Globe and the Washington Post, and there were all these stories about all boys, in these stories anyway, who were absolutely addicted to Fortnite and just could not get off, and, you know, fights with parents. And there was this whole, again, rash of headlines a few months ago about Fortnite addiction. So is that, exaggerated? Are people going overboard with this? Or is that a real thing?
Every time a game is released, there's always a small group of people who commit to a game and just will not stop. And, you know, that's where those horror stories come from of, you know, the man who did not leave his chair for 3 days and died. You know, like there are these there are these horror stories like that, and they tend to have been men in the past. But that I think there's a variety of reasons that could be true. But there is. I want to get back to this idea of what's pleasurable about a game. The idea that. That there's this promise of success and it doesn't happen all the time. And in psychology, we call this the variable ratio reward structure, that there's occasionally something given to us. So we know that there's promise out there. We know we'll get something someday. So we just keep working at it and we just keep working at it. And that that seems to drive this, if we want to use the term addiction, I tend not to use it, but then again, I'm not a physician. That sense of pleasure, that sense of little dopamine arrives. It is very calculated, in fact. And game designers spend hours and hours and hours, sometimes with casino designers, for example, to get that variable ratio reward structure just at the sweet spot, so that you always keep playing and always keep playing. Because often, of course, a game doesn't exist unless it's played. So you really need to keep your players. And keep them in there, keep them in your game, lest they go play another game. So, eyeball time.
That's key, and they don't make money if your eyeballs aren't on, you know, many hours a day. And that's really the last question I wanted to ask both of you. And Dr. Weigel, you first, what incentive, what interest perhaps do you see from game designers to make the games a little less addictive so that people will go outside and move their bodies? I mean, you and Professor Flanagan have both said, you know, look, it's not so much that these games are inherently bad, it's that some young people just spend way too much time on them and not enough time outside helping around the house, reading or whatever. Do you see any interest in the game designing companies to make these games a little bit easier to leave or stop?
Unfortunately, I don't. So, you know, this is a $120 billion industry. It's an entertainment juggernaut. It's bigger by some measures than the movie industry. And that money, as Professor Flanagan noted, is going into getting people to play and keeping them playing. And I do think I don't think that game designers are bad people, but when someone's job depends on them sort of not seeing the negative effects of their work, they're often inclined not to see it. I'm thinking of the cigarette industry, whose, you know, executives swore before Congress not 20 years ago that they didn't believe that that cigarettes were addictive. And they're really, you know, I don't think any industry is good at regulating itself, right? At regulating the harm it caused. And the cigarette industry, I do think, is a reasonable example of that. They had to be regulated from the federal government. And I worry that in order for the video game companies, who really they're beholden to their stockholders, and they're beholden to their bottom line more than they're beholden to the public health. That until I do think it would be very easy for game designers to build in safeguards to help people to have healthy habits, right? After you play for 8 hours, you stop earning a certain amount of rewards, or it just reminds you, hey, you've been playing for so long, maybe you should take a break. Something like that would be so easy for game designers to build in, but there's no incentive for them to do so currently. So I believe that until they are regulated from the outside, I don't believe that there will be a movement within the video game industry to help gamers maintain healthy habits.
Real quick to you, Professor Flanagan, last thoughts.
I would just caution game designers often do notice this stuff. They're the ones who want to make the best game. It's the corporate environment that is forcing their hand at not being able to have those reminders. But I would say that there's pushback on a number of levels, and there's pushback among the game design community. And in fact, there's a whole new generation of people making independent games. A lot of game designers go outside the studio system and make small independent games on their own that challenge some of these very notions. So,
oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah. So there's this indie games movement. There are game festivals. There's one called Indiecade. So they're and it's becoming a kind of a new movement for positive and different kinds of interaction.
All right. Both of you, we could have talked a lot longer. This was really interesting. I really appreciate you taking the time. Professor Flanagan, thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much, Laura.
And Dr. Weigel, thank you also. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.